Okay, so this is Parshat Nitzavim. It begins, Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem Lefnei Hashem Elokeichem Reshit Shivteichem Zekneichem Vishotreichem Kol Ish Yisrael. So without getting more detailed than necessary, the description that we're getting is that you're all gathered here today. Gathered from the top to the bottom, although he doesn't say that clearly. It's really the next pasuk: Tapchem Neshechem VeGerchasha BeKerev Machanecha MiChotiv Eitzim Adshoyev MeMecha. So it's basically saying everybody's here today. Rashi adds a little context, historical context, and Rashi says that this parsha takes place, or this particular speech, or part of the speech. It depends how you understand Sefer Devarim. Rashi says, "Melamed she kinasam Moshe lefnei Kadosh Baruch Hu biyom moto lachnisam babrit." That means, according to Rashi, this is the day that Moshe Rabbeinu will die. So, according to our Mesorah, Moshe dies in Zayin Adar. So that means, from here till the end of the Chumash, this all takes place on Zayin Adar. This takes place the day that Moshe is going to die. So, this really is now, as much as all of Sefer Devarim is Moshe's last speech, this really is the last speech. This is it. This is the end. So it does make it particularly poignant, but it also makes it for us particularly interesting to focus exactly, you know, what is it that's going to be introduced. Continues and says, L'avrecha b'vrit Hashem Elokecha uva'olato. That means that there's going to be a brit, a covenant, and a vow, which strengthens the brit, which means, aside from the other covenants that had taken place until this point, there is a covenant which is going to be forged on this day. Laman hikim otcha hayom lo la'am, in order to keep you for God as a people. V'yelocha l'elokim kasher diber loch, v'kasher nishba levotech la'avron liyitzak liyakov. So, again, Moshe is going to die. This is the last chance. This is it. And Pasuk Yod Gimel says something interesting. I'm going to ask a question that I don't know if I have a good answer to. I worked very hard last year to try to give an answer to it. I'm not completely convinced. I like the answer, which I'm not going to repeat now. The next Pasuk says, V'lo itchem levadchem anochi karet et habrit, and not to you alone am I forging this covenant, hazot, v'etel hazot, and this vow, ki et asher yeshno po imanu omed hayom lefnei Hashem lokenu, those who were standing in front of God today, the et asher einenu po imanu hayom, and those who were not standing in front of us today. The difficulty that I have is that if you look, there's a number of different gemarot who quote this pasuk, those who that the covenant is with those who are here and future generations, and quotes this pasuk as if it were said at Har Sinai. Are you familiar with that idea?
Yeah.
This is the pasuk they quote. Do you realize why that may be somewhat difficult?
Yes.
Right. We're not near Har Sinai. We're not near Har Sinai geographically. We're not near Har Sinai chronologically. So as I said, I worked very hard to try to give an explanation of this. But I'm throwing that out to you over here that, you know, this is so ingrained in us. If before I read this, if I would have said, is there some kind of a teaching that that a brit or a covenant that was forged is not just in that generation, future generations as well, all of you would have said to me, yeah, Har Sinai, and I would have asked you which pasuk, and it's possible one of you would have even quoted the pasuk, because the Gemara quotes the pasuk, and then I would have asked you where the pasuk says, and then you'd start having a harder time. Well, it's not so hard, because anything that you read during, you know, by Minchu or by Sheni or Chamishi, there's a chance that you know those psukim, but it's our minds fool us a little bit and say, oh, is this the only time it says this? So the answer is yeah, this is the only time it says this. Now, if you want, I said I'm not going to give the answer, but if you want, you could say it's a Kal Vachomer that if over here that future generations are included within this covenant, what is this covenant? But what is the connection? What's the content of the connection? That, again, whenever you have a covenant is between two sides. Okay, what's God's side? Okay, be good. Be a good God. Okay, what's our side? We will keep the mitzvot. So how does that help you at all? If you had to like go like this, like okay. Right, so then you'd say it's a kal v'chomer, that if over here Moshe is making them all promise, they're going to keep it, it includes pshat, right? Pasha pshat includes future generations, so therefore it means, although you can argue, therefore one could claim that it must include Har Sinai as well. And as I said, that's the way that the Gemara seems to take it, even though the Gemara doesn't do any of that legwork, it just says, oh, we know, you know clearly that all generations were included over here. Okay, there's a second element, which, and if that's the case, then we're stuck again. I try to work it out through the introduction of Hakel. Yeah. By the way, I'll just give you a hint. Almost anything that you ever ask me, I think it's possible, I will probably say yes, but go ahead. I would say it's possible, but I don't understand what you said. Else I would have said it's possible. Anybody understand him? Or is this just me? Yeah, I just want to see if we have to take him out and kill him or not. Yeah. I would like to see some kind of evidence for that. One does have to be careful sometimes in Chazal, when Chazal talk about Torah, what they mean by Torah. Chazal don't always mean the same thing that we think they mean. Like, just for example, there are a number of times that Chazal refers to Torah or what happened at Har Sinai, and they only limit it to Aseret HaDibrot and not to everything else. Right? Like, give you an example. God offered the Torah to various other nations, right? And you can fill in which nations. And they said, what does it say in the Torah? So what was the examples of what it says? All things from the Aseret HaDibrot. All things Aseret HaDibrot. When Moshe goes up, right, the Gemara in Shabbat, when Moshe goes up and the angels want to stop him, right? And they say, you write, a person born of flesh is going to take the Torah. So God says to Moshe, give them an answer. So then Moshe goes and says, you know, in the Torah it says that God took us out of Egypt, and all the examples, honor your parents, all the examples, again, are examples from Aseret HaDibrot. So it could be that there are times that the Chazal referred to as Matan Torah in its most narrow sense, even though there are times that Chazal go out of the way to tell you that Matan Torah means the broadest sense imaginable. I'm still saying, I'm still not completely sure what you wanted to say, but let's, yeah. It could be. There's Sadigon quoted by Rashi. It could be. That's why I said the broader sense. Second thing, which may be connected, which I think is connected, at the end of Perek, in Perek Kaf Ted Pasuk Kaf Ched, right, which is indeed the end of Perikov Ted, it says as follows, Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu, Vahaniglot Lanu Ulvanenu Ad Olam, Laasot Et Kol Divrei Torah Hazot, which by the way now goes back that the covenant could very well be about keeping the Torah, and not in a narrow sense. Rashi over here says, anybody know what Rashi says? It's a little sad, you need me for... Correct. Rashi says there's such a thing which is called mutual responsibility, which, by the way, is all I'm going to talk about today. Rashi says such a thing as mutual responsibility. Although he says mutual responsibility begins, who knows when? Maybe. Depends how you understand the Rashi, but maybe. But yes, very good. Rashi, because there's a couple places that you have to put together, but I'm going to read this Rashi as clear as possible. Ludrosh afa niglot lo anasha terabim ad sha'ovru et yardain misha kiblu et shvu bahar griz bahar eval v'nasu arevim ze leze. So there is such a thing which is called kol yisrael arevim ze leze. Is that a nice philosophical idea, or is that a halachic idea? Tell me, explain to me. One word answer is good, but go ahead. Our wives? Ah, okay. That must be the way that somebody had taught that. Okay, good. Your wives and your kids? Right. Right. Now, I'll ask you an unfair question. First of all, fact. If I was Yotzei a mitzvah, right, I was Yotzei Kiddush, I'm able to say Kiddush again. But I was... Now, I could say Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Lezeh should mean that if I say Kiddush, you're Yotze with my Kiddush, right? Right. All this. I'm sorry that I'm going to exaggerate this a little bit, but I want to make sure this is really clear. I could have said that's the whole thing. That when I do a mitzvah, someone else can say Amen, and when you say Amen, it's as if you said the bracha, it's as if you did the same thing, right? So we all know this concept that you could be Yotze with somebody else. If another Jew didn't say Kiddush, and I already said Kiddush, and I don't have to limit it to my wife and children, if another Jew didn't say Kiddush, and I already said Kiddush, can I say Kiddush again? And the answer is yes. Why? The why is more interesting than the halacha. The halacha is, yes, you can. Now the question is why? The Ran, in his commentary to Rosh Hashanah, Daf Kaf Ted, says that the obligation that every single one of us have to say Kiddush is an obligation multiplied by every single Jew in the world. Which means if another Jew didn't say Kiddush yet, I have not completely fulfilled my obligation. Which means, again, it doesn't make any sense. This is really what the Ron's trying to, you know, we're going to gain from this. It doesn't make any sense if I was already Yotze that I can say it again. Should be Baruch Levatala. How can I say it again? So the Ron ends up saying that no. I think the Ritva says as well. He says no. If some other Jew wasn't Yotze yet, you were not completely, now I have to add in that word completely, you were Yotze your own personal mitzvah, but you weren't completely Yotze. What's the proof that you weren't completely Yotze? What? The fact that I can say it again. So that must mean that there's some Kiyum mitzvah over here as well for me, but what's my Kiyum mitzvah? I was already making the mitzvah. My Kiyum mitzvah is, again, this is the claim, that if there are 600,000 Jews in the world, there are much more, then my obligation to say Kiddush is an obligation to say Kiddush times 600,000. No, I'm saying the whole time that one of them was not Yotze, I was not completely Yotze. That there was something missing over here. This is really, you know, I would say an extreme expression of this concept of Kol Yisrael Raven Zelazen. And I have a question. The question is going to be very, very simple. That's a very nice halacha. Why was this halacha not taught until the Jews, in the words of Rashi, crossed over the Jordan, came to Eretz Yisrael, and then stood by Har Eval? But again, why not? If somebody missed Kiddush during the 40 years in the desert, why can't I be Yotze them in Kiddush then? That's really what comes out of this. Why should this have to wait for that point? Right. So that's what I'm saying. This is an expression of this idea of mutual responsibility. Tell me now another expression of mutual responsibility. That may be correct, but I'm pointing it. Okay, let me say it a little differently. When we talk about mutual responsibility, who is the mutual responsibility between? Us and God, or us or another Jews? Which one? Both. Okay. So now, who are the other Jews that we're responsible for? All. Which all of them? We're getting somewhere now. All generations, which means mutual responsibility now, and that's what happens when you put these two different psukim together. On the one hand, there's mutual responsibility, which goes across every single Jew in this generation. On the other hand, I have mutual responsibility, which goes backwards and forwards in terms of different generations as well, and I want to try to explain both of these ideas a little bit more, because I think that's, as I said, that's the key of this week's parasha. That's what's being added over here. That's the difference between what we had before. Now we have mutual responsibility. So I'm going to ask the question again, and I don't know how many hints I have to give you along the way, but I can give you one really easy hint that you'll get then, and then it'll be very easy. Why is this being introduced now? So you could say, okay, this is it. Moshe's leaving. There's no, you know, because they're all here, but they were all here before also. And a matter of fact, especially the way that we saw the Chazal deal with this, it could have been said at Sinai. Mutual responsibility could have been felt, could have been already expressed at Sinai. What really is the difference? I mean, Sinai is
our land, permanence.
Correct. Which means that would have been my hint. My hint would have been this is like a Zionist answer, which is significant. A couple of months ago, when was it? I think March or so. I was a scholar in residence in Chicago, and they gave me a topic to talk, or maybe I chose the topic, I don't remember, on Friday night, which means it wasn't recorded. When it's not recorded, it means I can say whatever I want to. So the topic which I spoke about was the difference between religious Zionism and between modern Orthodoxy. That was the topic. Excuse me? Well, one of the things that I observed, you get some of it now. One of the things that I observed is that, either fortunately or unfortunately, most people or most groups end up defining themselves not in terms of their own narrow perspective of who they are, who they want to be, but rather they end up defining themselves in terms of who they don't want to be. Which means it's the people, it's the other, yeah, you hear me? It's the other who defines who I am. So therefore, what I tried to then explain was that the other in Israel is not necessarily the same other that you have in the United States. And that would account for one of the major differences between the two different... Again, it goes back to the joke of the Jew on the desert island, right? And he builds how many shuls? Depends on which version. How many? So it's three. It's actually three. The joke is actually he builds three shuls. One is the one he normally daven. It's one when he gets into a fight. It's where he can daven. And the third is the one he'd never step foot into. Okay? But to what extent does the Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist groups help define what Orthodoxy is?
And that existed before.
Very good. Orthodoxy was, the term Orthodoxy was made up by the Reform. They called them Orthodox, right? They made up the term. Very good. But I'm saying, to what extent did they help formulate what Orthodox ends up becoming? And again, right here I'll point out that in Israel, and I apologize to anybody who will disagree with me on this, there really is no Reform or Conservative to speak of. There's a secular, but there's really no Reform or Conservative to speak of. So over there, so just on that level, the other will end up being in America the Reform Conservative, and a lot of positions, I'm afraid to use the word halacha, although I can give you examples of halacha, a lot of positions that were taken were positions that were taken in order to differ between the Conservative and the Reform versus what the Orthodox wanted to see themselves as being. On the other hand, as I said, in Israel, that doesn't really exist in terms of that other. The other, you have a secular other, but the secular other is very, very different from a Reform or Conservative. And among the Sfaradim, it's far more interesting, because among Sfaradim, the other, more often than not, is somebody who will define themselves as Mesorati. And the Mesorati will come to the same shuls. And the Mesorati will respect the same rabbis. The Mesorati will have a very, very different perspective than the quote-unquote Conservative Reform, who have a completely different ideology. And for that matter, by the way, the Mesorati, who may not be Shomer Shabbos, will end up being far more observant than many, than virtually all Reform and many Conservatives. So as you said, things are a little complicated. But that's one little example how the other helps define who you are, because we don't live in vacuums. But let me say it a little differently. One of the biggest differences between life in Israel versus life within a diaspora community is the sense of religion within what I would call, using a term from Shabbat, within the Reshut HaRabim. Which means there really is no Reshut HaRabim aspect of law when it comes to religious life in America. A shul is not a Reshut HaRabim, and I apologize for that. A community center, a shul, is not a Reshut HaRabim. You can tell me it is, but it really isn't. And what it is a lot of individuals who gather together. But, for example, now with the end of Shemitah coming, people, I assume, are writing a prusbul. So you have all the banks in Israel and all the people will be writing prusbuls because this is part of our heter iska, right? That's going to happen to all the banks over there. Banks in America, it's no issue. And again, these are small little examples, but what is the bigger, larger, looming issue? It becomes this point of mutual responsibility, which means when one lives in a diaspora community, that sense of mutual responsibility doesn't really exist. The reason it doesn't really exist because you are a reshut hayachid, unless you consider yourself a Makom Patur, you are a Reshut HaYachid, and there is no real expression of the Reshut HaRabim. This, by the way, I think, is one of the larger issues which will cause tension within the various levels, I say that with the lack of a better term for it, of observance within Israel. And again, I'll be very, very clear about this. And I speak for myself, I don't speak for the yeshiva. They can all say, whoever wants to say, could disagree with what I have to say about this. This past year was a Shemitah year. I don't even know what they do in the yeshiva. I never asked. What do they do? Right? Otzer Beis Din? Okay. In terms of halacha, Otzer Beis Din is the weakest possible way of solving the... It's completely made up. There's no source whatsoever. But okay. Was that good enough? That'll get somebody going. There is a real Otzer Beis Din. There is a real Otzer Beis Din, which is talked about in the Tosefta. But the real Otzer Beis Din was not paskened in the Yerushalmi, doesn't bring it down, was not paskened in the Bavli, is not paskened by the Rambam. A handful of Rishonim do bring it down. For example, the Ramban cites the Otzer Beis Din, but he says the reason to have Otzer Beis Din is to make sure that there's no commerce. Which means if it's Otzer Beis Din, it can't be bought and sold. The stuff they have in the yeshiva, do they buy it? They don't buy it at all? There's nothing bought? Of course they buy it.
No.
Any what? Yeah, of course it is. Right. So I'm saying that's all very nice, but that's not, as I said, it's not brought in the Shulchan. It's not brought in the Shulchan Aruch. It's not brought in the Rambam. It's not brought in the Yerushalmi. It's not brought in the Bavli. And the ones who do bring it, again, for example, the Ramban says in order to make sure it can't be any commerce. Most places in Israel where there is an Otzer Beis Din, the Otzer Beis Din products cost more money than any other produce. Now, how in the world it can cost more money when it can't be sold? It just can't be sold. I'll be clearer then. I'm sorry. I'll be clearer. Otzer Beis Din is mentioned in the Tosefta. The Tosefta says as follows, that the farmers would come into town, and then, now even the Tosefta, you have to be medayik. It said, in the olden days, which means it's mashma from the Tosefta, it no longer is in practice even the time of the Tosefta. It says this is what they used to do. In the olden days, a farmer would come in. Why would a farmer come in with produce? Because he wanted to sell it. What would the Beit Din do? They would confiscate it. What would they then do? They would give it out for free. So the farmer wasn't paid. The person who gets it doesn't pay for it. Now you understand the Ramban. There's no commerce going on over here. The only time the Tosefta speaks about putting money in, and it sounds like the money comes from the Beit Din. There were those who claimed that the money is the only time the Beit HaMikdash and the money came from the Shkolim. There are those then who say that in order to turn the grapes into wine, in order to develop the produce, then you would put money in, but it never said the consumer would pay for it. Which means the Otzer Beis Din is something which does exist, although it may not be the halacha. As I keep saying, the Rishami doesn't know of it, and the Rambam doesn't paskin this way. The Ramban says that, yeah, it's there that you don't pay any money for it. So again, if you were to ask me, Otzer Beis Din is a terrible solution with practically the way it's done today, no source whatsoever. But that's not what bothers me about it. What bothers me about it is that Otzer Beis Din is not a good solution for the entire country. There aren't enough people who are willing to conduct themselves in the way that the Otzer Beis Din would require. And it's true that the Chazon Ish liked it, and it's true that certain people claim that it was Rav Kook's idea, even though it wasn't. He was in favor of it, but the reason he was in favor of it was because no one was buying the Heter Mechira. So he said. So then some people, and I think I know whose idea it was, but that's not for now, that somebody had this idea to try to bring back the Otzer Beis Din. Rav Kook signed off on it as well, and his idea actually was to do Otzer Beis Din and the Heter Mechira together, which didn't fly whatsoever. But let's go back a second. What bothers me, go back to what our topic is, if I've already lost you. What was our topic? Till spoken to me. It was about mutual responsibility, which means if there are 8 million people living in this country, I need a solution for Shemitah that will feed 8 million people. One second, did that make any sense? That's mutual responsibility. If I come up with a solution which is only going to feed 100,000 people, that's not a solution on terms of a mutual level, which means there are certain Jews, and I can explain to this historically, there are certain Jews who treat living in a big state like this, you make believe the state doesn't exist, and you treat it as if you're in a shtetl. But it's worse than a shtetl. And again, I'll explain why this is, and we're talking, and then we'll have to try to make sense out of some of this. There was a feeling among people who came to the original Yishuv that when you live in the land of Israel, which is a holy land, you need to deserve to be here. What does it mean to deserve to be here? It means that in the olden days, and on this point we can open up dozens or hundreds, really, of Shailos and Tshuvos, and look at the way that the great poskim answered question. When I say the great poskim, I mean the Chatam Sofer, the Noda Yehuda, and Rav Akiva Eiger, and we can go on and on. The way that the great poskim always answered questions. And then we can look what happened to the attitude towards halacha in Israel. Simple shift took place. People felt that even though in Chutz La'aretz you could be Makel, and there were rules to be Makel, Sefer Direct to the Chumra, Sefer Direct to the Kula, and I can go on and on and on. People, traditionally, many Rabbanim were Machmir for themselves, Makel for others, and I can, again, if there was a sheet to rely on and so on. But when it came to the Yishuv, they said we need to deserve to live in the land of Israel. In order to deserve to live here, we need to follow the stricter opinion, because we're basically living here in God's territory, which was very nice when the Yishuv was very small. Essentially then, when the non-religious Zionists start to come in, the small Yishuv living on exaggerated standards of religiosity, with people who are anti-religious, at worst, sometimes just non-religious at best, you have a very small very strong tension. Essentially, these are two different worlds. This was what really got Rav Kook into trouble. Because when Rav Kook comes up, and it wasn't his idea, the Hetu Mechira. Hetu Mechira was hundreds of years before Rav Kook ever got here, and it was two Shemitot before Rav Kook got here. It was institutionalized on a much broader level. Rav Kook gets blamed for it, even though, as I said, it was not his idea. But what did Rav Kook say again and again and again? He praised the non-religious people. He said they're shlichim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu because they're building up the land of Israel. Meaning, what Rav Kook really was saying is what other people weren't saying, goes back to our point. And what's that? There's mutual responsibility over here. And these people are shlichim from God. And now, therefore, what can I do for these people? And he would come up with the Hetu Mechira, not just because people were starving, and they were, but because I have to make sure the non-religious guys are going to eat as well. How did the religious people eat during the early Shemitah? They raised money. It was a great fundraising campaign. Come support the farmers in Israel, and you know you can share in the Shemitah and so on, and you would people making donations. That's how people lived. You get donations. I mean, by the way, you all realize, of course, they probably made more money during the Shemitah year than there really was a bracha, like the Torah says. They got enough for 3 years. They really were raising money at that point, and this was a wonderful reason to raise money. And Rav Kook is coming and saying, no, the farmers need to work the land, and we need to come out to some kind of a heter. And as I said, the heter was in place before Rav Kook even arrived. It was institutionalized to Shemitah beforehand, and the heter was given by the great Rabbanim in Europe, which the Ada said, mind your own business, you know, we need to be machmir over here. Why are you coming up with a terem, which really go against and hurt us. It hurts us because they couldn't raise money if there really was. I'm not being so cynical, but the real issue over here is one of mutual responsibility. Do I care about the secular farmers? Right now, today, should I... The Heter Mechira is a wonderful solution to feed 8 million people. There is no other solution today which will feed 8 million people. So now, as a posek, what am I supposed to tell people? I'm being very serious now. As a posek, what am I supposed to tell people in terms of Shemitah? Again, one way of looking at it, here's the one which on a theoretical level is the best possible solution for an individual, but it's not possible to do for everybody. Aside from issues like maybe buying from people that certain individuals find may not necessarily be within the interest of the national security to be supporting. Rav Nachman Kahana said that you're allowed to buy fruits and vegetables from Arabs. Rav Nachman Kahana, if you don't know, is Rav Meir Kahana's brother. He's a big Talmud Chacham. But I'm quoting B'Shem Amro. He said the only thing is that before you eat it, you have to soak and salt it to take the blood out. Which is unbelievably, unbelievably cynical. My son's Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Reima Cohen, said that. That you're not allowed to buy from again people involved in terrorist activity. Certainly, he said that it's abizrayu to ritzicha. So I'm saying, Those are obviously very, very strong statements. But again, I'm asking a simple question. Do I have to, when I look at halacha, come to a solution for 8 million people, or do I only look? I'm going to give you another example, which if you never heard this, at least I get to surprise you again. As religious people, should we be in favor or not in favor of civil marriage in Israel? Civil marriage. Civil marriage. In America, you have civil marriage. Two people want to get married. By the way, I'm talking about heterosexual marriage, okay? Just in America, you guys are discussing other things. I'm talking like a man and a woman kind of marriage, right? All that I'm asking over here is, should they be allowed to get married? Justice of the peace, go to court, go to wherever they want to. Should they be able to get married? Or should we be insisting that everybody gets married only kedas v'kedin, only everybody gets married according to halacha? Right. So vast majority of religious people are absolutely in favor that people should get married in kedas v'kedin. On the other hand, the first time I heard this, I was shocked. The 10th time I heard it, I was no longer shocked. There are certain rabbis who, when they perform weddings for non-religious people, will passel the wedding. Because you know about this. You know about this. What? Who gave a shir?
Yeah.
And he was in favor.
No, he just said this.
So your Rosh Hashiva talked about this. Okay, he said that the people will passel the weddings on purpose, bring two witnesses that are passel or whatever it is, and no other one. They'd passel it on purpose. Why? Because they say most non-religious people. By the way, I'm not saying this. This is the presumption. Most non-religious women will cheat on their husbands, so therefore it's better if they're not married. It's lifnei iver to perform the wedding properly. By the way, it may be Gnevis Das to tell somebody you're marrying them. And if you took money to perform the wedding, it may actually be Gneva, right, to do it. But you have people that go and do it. Now, I have to ask a question. So maybe it'd be better just to have civil marriages in Israel rather than faking religious marriages. Again, just to think out loud. I'm not saying this is a simple issue. You think the conversion issue in Israel right now is a simple issue? Bottom line, in a generation or two, you're going to have many, many people who are not halachically Jewish, and what you're going to have is an unbelievable amount of intermarriage in Israel. It used to be, you come to Israel, say, okay, figure somebody, okay, well, at least they'll end up marrying another Jew. Unless somebody solves this problem, and there are solutions, unless somebody solves the problem, you're going to have a huge problem. But this comes back to this issue of mutual responsibility. I could say, but listen, how many people, you know, what they call Anshei Shlomenu, Anash, you see it in a lot of Hasidic, especially Chabad writings, you never saw that be. Aleph Nun Shin, it means Anshei Shlomenu, our people, Unzura mentioned. By our people don't do this, so who cares about the other people? But that goes exactly what we've learned today. When you're about to cross the border, you're about to cross the Yarden, you're going to come into Eretz Yisrael, you no longer live in a little shtetl, and now issues that take place become issues of mutual responsibility. And you can no longer look at things in terms of only my own small, narrow standards over here. I need to figure out a way of having standards that may be lower, but will be inclusive for other people as well. And as I said... people can disagree with every single word that I said today. It's okay. Won't be the first. It's fine. But I'm just trying to explain that's what this parsha is expressing. Even if you want to implement it in different ways that I'm saying, or the examples that I'm giving, that's what this parsha is about. If you're about to come into a country, you're creating an entity, a national entity. A national entity has one where there has to be mutual responsibility. It can't just be that I only think about myself, my own Dalet Amos, and there's nothing else that I'm concerned of. That's exactly why, at this particular junction, we have this concept of mutual responsibility. Kol Yisrael Erevim Zelazeh. To the extent, and this is surprising, to the extent, you know, I couldn't be Yotzei somebody else in Kiddush before this particular point. That's the point, which is interesting. In terms of the positive part, it's normally said once they cross the Yarden. The thing about Har Gwizim, Har Eval, as I said, that may also be what Losa say. I'm not 100% sure what I just now said. Yeah?
Should we be able to be someone in Kiddush or not in Israel?
I know that would be the funny conclusion of this, but don't take it that far. The reality is that this is when it began, which means even... Right, we became a nation, which means that even when we're in Chutz La'aretz, we're still a nation, but we're a nation who's outside of their land. And that's the way we looked at it, otherwise who would have ever come back? mean, the fact that we ended up coming back is because we still had this sense of nationhood. Okay, that was one part of it. But let's go back to the other part. What was the other part that we saw? The other part is how this idea of mutual responsibility goes through generations as well. There is a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Lamed Bet. Lamed Bet, not to be confused with the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Tet Zayin. Tet Zayin is where we have Amar Rav Kuspidai, Amar Rav Yochanan. There are three different books, right? What are the three books? Tzaddikim, Rishayim, and Beinonim, right? The Gemara in Lamed Bet says there are two books which are open, and the Gemara there begins a little differently. The more I think about it, I think the Gemara is fascinating and phenomenal. The Gemara says that the Malchei Ashares, the angels in heaven, complain to God. And what's their complaint? They say, why is it that Am Yisrael don't say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? I want to pause there for a second. We're not part of this conversation. This is a conversation that takes place in heaven between God and between the Malchei Ashares. We're down here on earth. If somebody asked us why don't we say it, what would our answer be? Because we're scared. What are we scared of? It's Yom HaDin. By the way, that's the Yerushalmi that I told you that the Torah quotes as a Midrash. The Yerushalmi actually says that when somebody stands in judgment in front of Basar V'dam and so on, then they're scared and they fast and so on and so forth. But we stand in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, so we eat and we drink, and it's very strange. But by the way, why did the Torah bring this Yerushalmi? Why did he bring it? He brought it, and he says, as an argument against people who have the minhag of fasting on Rosh Hashanah. Why do people fast on Rosh Hashanah? Exactly what you said, it's Yom HaDin, they're scared. If I'm not mistaken, the Rav said that his great-grandfather, the Beis Halevi, fasted on Rosh Hashanah on both days. Ate at night, fasted both days on Rosh Hashanah. How can you not fast? It's Yom HaDin. You're standing in front of Melech Malchim Lachim. How can you not fast? As I said, the Torah brings a Medrash, he quotes it as a Medrash from the Shalmi that goes against this. And says, no, we should be happy on this day. So now, yeah? Excuse me? Yom Kippur is also Yom HaDin. It's also Yom HaDin. Yom Kippur, but it's also Yom HaDin. Let me ask you something. Are you scared of Yom Kippur? Good. So the answer given in the Gemara, again, this is Lamed Bet Rambam. The answer given in the Gemara is the Kodesh Baruch who says that it's a day of Din, right? And it says that a Kodesh Baruch who is sitting B'din, and he's sitting B'din, and it says, Sifrei Chayim V'Sifrei Mesim Menuchim Lefanav. What does that mean? The book of the living and the book of the dead are open in front of him. Now what? First of all, it leaves out Beinonim. So the first thing you can ask, hold a second, what happened to Beinonim? But it's not just Beinonim that it left out. The Gemara earlier said, the book of Tzaddikim, Rishoyim, and Beinonim. Over here, it's at Sifrei Chayim and Sifrei Mesim. Now, there are those who would want to assume that it's talking about the same thing. And therefore, the Sifrei Tzaddikim is a Sifrei Chayim, and the Sifrei Mesim is a Sifrei Rishayim, and then we have to wonder, so what happened to the book of the Beinonim? I guess there are not all that many Beinonim around. Beinonim are not written. Beinonim are Tluim V'Omdim. But it's still, the early Gemara says Shalosh Svarim. They're Tluim V'Omdim. So, Barosh Hashanah, we paskin in the mounts of Barosh Hashanah, Yikosevim. V'Yom Tzom Kippur, Yikosevim. So you still have a problem. So, as far as I recall, Rav Chaim Volozhin asked this question. And the way he asked it was not the way that he assumed that it's the same thing. He asked the opposite. He said, I don't understand. The Sifrei Chaim is open because God judges every person who's alive to see what they've done this year. But why does God open up the Sifrei Mesim of people who are dead already? They haven't done anything recently. Why does this book have to be opened up? Which means the way that he asked the question is very obvious. He did not understand that these two books are the same as the book of the Tzaddikim and the book of the Rishayim. This is a completely different thing. Sifrei Chaim is people who are alive, and Sifrei Mesim are those who are dead. The answer which is given to this is that on every single year, God judges the living for what they've done this year, and he judges the dead for the impact that they've had on the world in this year. Which means that just because somebody's dead, and even dead a long time, let me ask you a question. I want a moderate estimation of how many people in the world today learned Rashi. You can guess. Throw a number. I'll agree.
4 million.
4 million? You're crazy. I won't agree. Hundreds of thousands. Hundreds of thousands of people today, right? Would you say more? If you want to take it up to 1 million, I'll give you 1 million. 4 million's too much. Right? Hundreds of thousands of people learned Rashi today. What about yesterday? And the day before? So, how does this impact Rashi's and the Shema? Do you understand my question? How does this impact his neshama? Which means if Rashi was judged at the point that he passed away, he was judged, he stood in front of the Beis Din HaGadol, right? And he stood and he was judged for good, possibly bad, whatever. Rabbeinu Tam would say he'd be judged for wearing tefillin Rashi, okay, whatever. So he's judged, but every single day since then, and the number gets bigger, once you realize that, the number gets bigger every single year. Yes or no? Right. Every single year, more and more people are learning Rashi. So that means as Rashi moves on, Rashi's had a better career since he's been dead, right? Since compared to most rabbis who are alive. Would you agree with this? Or you wouldn't say all rabbis that are alive. Yes? Rashi teaches more Torah than any other person today. Rashi taught more Torah today than any rabbi alive. Yes?
Yeah.
So I'm saying that's an unbelievable thought, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu opens up the Sifrei Mason and takes a look and says, okay, so what have you done lately? So again, admittedly, there are some people who are long dead, and what's the answer going to be to that question? They've done nothing. They haven't left any impact. On the other hand, and this is where I think we get to the greatest possible expression of free will. And I'm going to pause with my question, and I'm going to come back to it in a minute. Most people think that free will is my ability to look in the present and decide what I'm going to do as I go present moving towards future. I have free will. I have different choices. By the way, what are my choices? That's more complicated. People think that free will is just that between good and evil, then you've just taken free will out of 99.9% of decisions you make in your life. Free will most likely is on every single thing that you do, which one of these will bring me closer to God, and then you have long-term or short-term considerations. Right? Which one of these paths that I have, and not every single decision is going to have that kind of impact. Which decision here will bring me closer to God? That's what free will is. But because we have a concept, which is also mentioned in this week's parasha, because we have a concept which is called tshuva, tshuva allows me to utilize my free will to turn around to something that I've done in the past and say, I'm sorry for what I've done. I have charata for what I've done. If I would be thinking, clearly, if I would have been thinking clearly then, I never would have done it. I'm embarrassed what I've done. I take upon myself, I'll never do it again. And if you want, you can even say, Achiya Idalov Yodea Talumos, right, until you call upon God who knows all secrets, to testify that I'll never do this thing again. And it could be at that moment I have 100% sincerity, never do it again. So that means I can utilize my free will to change what I did yesterday, which means free will is not just about what I'm doing today towards the future. My free will can change the reality of what I did yesterday. If you follow the opinion that we find of Reish Lakish in the Gemara, and it's very interesting and very ironic that it's Reish Lakish, who we know was a Baal Tshuva, who says that there are times that I can even take my chatoyim, my zdonot, and turn them into zchuyot, that I have the ability of taking something which objectively was a wicked behavior when I did it, and flip it around and turn it into something which now became a positive behavior. How in the world does that work? How can I take something which was negative, and now because I did tshuva, now it becomes positive? I'll tell you a story about Reish Lakish. It's also Yerushalmi. See, we started Yerushalmi, middle Yerushalmi, end of Yerushalmi. There's Yerushalmi in Trumot that says that two Rabbanim, Rav Imi and Rav Isi, one Rav, there's two different girsos, if it's Rav Imi or Rav Isi, was kidnapped. Rav Yochanan heard that he was kidnapped, and Rav Yochanan said, start getting the shrouds ready for the funeral. Nothing we can do. Reish Lakish comes out and says, over my dead body. Either they're going to have to kill me, or I'll kill them. Right? One second, can you picture Reish Lakish saying that? You all know that Reish Lakish himself was a criminal. He used to work as a, he worked as a gladiator, he worked as a circus performer. Reish Lakish was the unusual, very, very tough Jew. The Gemara tells us people that he killed, also, by the way, when he was involved in his other life. Reish Lakish hears, Rav Yochanan hears this guy's kidnapped, says, forget about it, dig the grave. Reish Lakish hears that he's kidnapped, says, over my dead body, either they're going to have to kill me. And by the way, the Gemara then says, he finds them, he finds this group, and he negotiates his release. He doesn't have to use his strength, which means once you have strength, you don't have to use it. Once you're not afraid, you're able to get yourself in a situation, and he gets him out, and he saves him. As far as I'm concerned, that's the perfect example of taking somebody's misspent youth as a gladiator, as a circus performer, as a robber, as a tough guy, and now he used it to save somebody's life. Again, in my imagination, it's exactly then that Reish Lakish says, the greatest tshuva, gedola tshuva, shizdonos naslos kizchuyos. Something that was done bizadun then. What gave him the guts to go and get involved in these guys? What gave him? Because he says, these guys aren't so tough. I could take these guys on. I'm not afraid of these guys. But I'm saying it's his misspent youth. It's his sins. In context, they were sins. And it was only because he had a misspent youth he was able to save somebody's life. At that moment, when he's willing to go and get involved and threaten to kill somebody, but at this point, not to take his money, but to liberate somebody. At that moment, did Reish Lakish reinterpret his past? Yeah. Which is what I'm saying. That is this unbelievable aspect of free will, that we have the ability of taking mistakes that we've done in the past and use them as the foundation for the mitzvah that we're going to do tomorrow. Now, if I take this in terms of myself, it's 100% true. But what's the point in terms of mutual responsibility? I can also take lives of other people and find something positive to be inspired by something negative that was done in context to be able to have the strength and the inspiration to do something positive. Which means we have the ability of elevating the neshamot of our grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents and so on. If you've never possibly imagined, how could it be after so many years that Mashiach can possibly come? And we can all admit there were generations that were better than us and more religious than us, and they kept Shabbos better, and maybe they learned more and all kinds of things. But this generation has the ability of not just using free will present towards future, we have the ability of opening up the Sefer HaMeitim as well, the Book of the Dead as well, and elevating neshamos of people who are no longer with us, and turning those neshamos into something which is positive, because God can then say, okay, what did this guy do recently? You know what this guy did? He inspired somebody to do something which was positive. It's this unbelievable concept which comes out of mutual responsibility, which means on the one hand, mutual responsibility is my... As I said, I could say Kiddush for you because if you didn't hear Kiddush, then there's some part of my neshama that wasn't Yotzei Kiddush as well. Yeah, I was Yotzei Kiddush, but not completely. And with every single Jew who didn't say Kiddush, I need to feel in my neshama that if every single Jew in the world didn't say Kiddush, then I'm lacking my Kiddush as well. I did not complete. Not just that I can, I can still say Kiddush, because there's a halacha that I could be Yotzei you. It's not just a halacha I could be Yotzei you. That's the Kiddush of the Ran. It's not just a halacha. Yes, it's a halacha. But it's not just the halacha. What is it? It's saying that there's something within me which is still lacking because of what? Because there is this concept of mutual responsibility, of Kol Yisrael Ravim Zeh L'Zeh. But what is Yisrael? People that are here today and people that aren't here today. What is Yisrael? Yisrael is the past, the present, and the future. Rav Soloveitchik would say, who owns Eretz Yisrael? He said, Eretz Yisrael is given to Klal Yisrael. Who's Klal Yisrael? Every single Jew who's ever lived throughout history. If every single Jew in Israel today says, we hereby relinquish our rights to the land of Israel, you take it, we're going to move to Uganda. It's absolutely meaningless because we don't own it. We're caretakers right now because we happen to be alive. Torah. Who did God give Torah to? Now we'll go back to the way the Gemara uses the pasuk. Who did God give Torah to? Every single generation who ever lived. If a Jew wants to learn Torah, do I have an obligation to teach them? Yes. Why? Because it's their inheritance. If I don't teach it to them, I am stealing their inheritance. What if they don't value their inheritance? I have to explain this to them. This is something which is an unbelievable inheritance that God gave to your ancestors and to you. You were standing there as well. You also received it. And therefore, this is something which you own. It's your birthright. You own this. So this concept of mutual responsibility, as I said, it's mutual responsibility for Klal Yisrael. But in order to really, really understand this, we need to have a really finely developed understanding of what is Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael is not just all the Jews. And again, I say this deliberately, all the Jews alive right now, but it's all the Jews from the past and all the Jews in the future, and we have a responsibility towards the past and we have a responsibility to the future. Fine. Everyone should have a ksiva v'ksiva tova.